Encore, encore, ladies and gentlemen, join us encore une fois for another episode of Worst Foot Forward, one of our intermittent bonus episodes, The Third Foot, where we take on a topic with a little bit more insight and dive for nuggets of trivia in the sewers of despair beneath humankind. Alongside me on this spelunking mission is my partner in knowledge, Ben Vandeveld. Hello, Ben.
Hello there. You made that sound legal and almost matrimonial, that we have both been accepted as each other's partners in knowledge.
Partners in knowledge, yeah. Well, I'm being a bit self-indulgent this month, Ben, because, as you will know, I've just had the press night of my play the night before we recorded this. Breeding, playing at the King's Head Theatre in London until the 14th of April. Tickets available at kingsheadtheatre.com. And so I thought for our bonus episode this month, we might look at theatrical traditions and superstitions and things like that.
Oh, great. Yeah. That reminds me of that really good Shakespeare play I saw the other week in Scotland.
Saving that till the end. Oh, yeah, Timon of Glasgow. Yeah, we'll talk about the big one at the end, but we're going to have to warm up to it. And we're going to warm up by talking about a chap called Samuel Foote, who was an actor and theatre manager and writer in the 1700s. One of those could kind of do everything, not necessarily all very well types, but was heavily involved in the theatre scene. And it was a time when you had to have licences to run theatres and so on. And so there was a lot of unlicensed theatre being produced. And the way the producers would get around the licensing laws is that they would do things like serve a meal and charge for the meal, and the entertainment was free. So the play would be incidental to the restaurant they were pretending to be running, even though the restaurant was in a theatre.
I have performed at too many comedy clubs like that for this not to already be enormously triggering for me.
Yeah. So Samuel Foote was one of those people, and I like the act. He opened one of his own plays called The Diversions of the Morning, or A Dish of Chocolate, in April 1747, and it was a satire on various people and public figures. And the dish of chocolate in the title referred to the dish that he was offering to accompany the entertainment. So he was very self-referentially advertising what the freebie would be in the title of the play he would do alongside it to avoid the licensing act. The morning after the performance, the theatre was locked and audiences were gathering for a performance at noon. They'd often stage matinees as another way to get around the law, who might only be knocking on the theatres in the evening to check that they had their licences. And so the audiences were turned away. And Foote also taking, you know, pot shots at other actors in his satire meant that he was very much not popular with a lot of the other people on the theatre scene in the city. And so I think possibly the word got out among other theatre managers that this guy's producing unlicensed theatre, you should go and crack down on him. But nevertheless, he managed to keep going. He produced A Cup of Tea as another review later on, and again offered tea. And then he went to Paris and he opened a show called The Auction of Pictures, which satirised the satirist Henry Fielding. And there was a sort of a war of words between Fielding and Foote. Fielding denounced Samuel Foote in the Jacobite's Journal, saying, "You, Samuel Foote, be pissed upon with scorn and contempt as a low buffoon, and I do, with the utmost scorn and contempt, piss upon you accordingly." And he seemed to had a habit of getting into sort of various beefs with people. Similarly, he got into a sort of a tete-a-tete with Charles Macklin, who was another actor he'd worked with, Macklin, previously. And Macklin had opened a school of oratory, and Foote satirised these in a series of mock lectures, which began to take on even more of an immersive feeling when Macklin showed up at these lectures himself to heckle. And so Foote, at one of the lectures, then improvised a piece of nonsense prose to test Macklin's assertion that Macklin could memorise any text at a single reading. And so Foote came out with, and I wanted to trigger warn, there is a term that has been reappropriated as a potential racial slur in the following paragraph. Foote then recited, "So she went into the garden to cut a cabbage leaf to make an apple pie, and at the same time a great she-bear coming up the street pops its head into the shop. What, no soap? So he died, and she's very imprudently married the barber, and there were present the pickninnies and the job lilies and the gariulies and the grand pandandrum himself, with the little round button at top, and they all fell to playing the game of catch-as-catch-can till the gunpowder ran out at the heels of their boots." Can you recite that, Ben?
No.
No, and Macklin couldn't either. But that paragraph was also the first instance of the use of the term the Grand Panjandrum in the English language. And that name was borrowed, as you might remember, for that big weapon, the explosive device in World War II, which was the big wheel with all of the rockets on it that they tried to use on that beach.
I recognised it.
The Grand Panjandrum, the Great Panjandrum, I think they referred to it as. But yes, that's the first instance of that appearing. So a little worst foot forward bit of a cohesion there. But the reason I wanted to mention Foote in the first place is that he was out riding with Prince Edward, the Duke of York, in 1766, and he was thrown from his horse. And the injury meant he damaged his leg, ironically, being someone who was called Foote. And he still managed to act, and it seems that as a compensation for his injury, he was granted a license to legally operate the Haymarket Theatre. And he opened a season of legitimate plays in 1767.
I love the idea of legitimate and illegitimate theatre. It's like, the only other place you see that is in the official and unofficial Backstreet Boys manual 1998.
Yeah, well, the thing I love about that is that this suggestion is that this is one of the possible origins of the term break a leg to wish actors and theatre people good luck. Because in breaking his leg, in the being thrown from the horse, the compensation of being granted the license allowed Foote to finally get some legitimacy and earn some good money from the theatre he was making.
I see, that is clever.
Yes, and there are lots of potential reasons for break a leg being used. One of the other suggestions is it's just how one might bow or curtsy. You sort of break the line of your leg to get lower. That's sort of that. One of the other suggestions. And then I just found a list of various different theatrical superstitions, which not all of which I'd heard of. Never apply makeup with a rabbit's foot is the first on this list. So, I'm not entirely sure. I don't know who goes about doing that day to day anyway.
I mean, if it's still attached to the rabbit, logistically it's going to be tricky.
Yes, magicians, maybe they do that. Never paint the green room green.
Sure.
Never open a show on a Friday. Never place shoes or hats on dressing room furniture. Never knit in the wings. Never wear new makeup on opening night. Never say a theatre is closed because they closed the theatres during the plague. Instead, you should say a theatre is dark. And people still say that today. Never exit the dressing room right foot first. You should exit it with your left foot first, apparently. Put your best foot forward. And never say the last lines of a show before opening night or bow to an empty theatre. Now, multiple plays I've been in, the directors do not choreograph the bow until basically just before the first public showing.
Yep.
So that's, I suppose, is a remnant of that. Never leave a stage dark is one of my favourite ones. Have you heard of the ghost light?
What, the light that must be kept on at all times? That's almost a little bit like a synagogue having the everlasting light on.
Or like eternal flames at the tomb of the unknown soldier and things like that. There's often lots of theatres will still have a single light left on. There are practical reasons, of course. You're in a room where a lot of the lights are, you know, operated from a desk in a specific room, so having a single light on means you can cross the stage safely without having to get the actual theatre lights turned on. But there is a superstitious suggestion for it, is that all theatres are haunted, apparently, by the ghost of the ancient Greek actor Thespian. So the light is there to ward him away or keep him at bay. But more recently, in the 19th century, theatres were lit by gaslight, and there were so many fires in theatres between the introduction of gaslighting in Philadelphia in 1816 and London's Savoy Theatre was the first electrically lit theatre in 1881, so that's what, 65 years or so, and just so many theatre fires, and even beyond that point. So what leaving a ghost light on, one of these lights burning, was it allowed, it prevented pressure from building up in the gas line by just having a single light low burning at a low wattage. So there is probably practical, if not superstitious, reasons mm-hmm. for keeping a ghost light on. Peacock feathers. Is there? Do you have superstition about peacock feathers?
I mean, I don't. I'm not a superstitious person at all. I clang into any theatrical dressing room with a mop bucket on one foot with ostrich feathers and peacock feathers, loudly reciting from Macbeth. And I mean, I say that I felt bad saying that name in a house with a Scottish wife who somehow feel like gives me protection. This house is not a theatre, and you're going to be in the theatre for the next 6 hours. But nevertheless, I'm not going to do it again.
It's funny. I get superstitious, not superstitious, but I suppose it's like any, like a sports person preparing for a match or a game. They like having their routine.
Mm. Oh yeah.
And you sort of feel a bit incomplete if you haven't done the full routine. So I mean, the play I'm in at the moment, I have a specific routine of a list of songs I listen to while I'm doing my warm up, in an order in which I do things beforehand. And my thing that I do before going on stage is I grow a tail, Ben. Yeah. big revelation for you. I do an exercise where I imagine myself growing a tail, and it gives me a sort of sense of playfulness depending on what the type of tail
that is. Very sweet.
And yeah, it's a good one. And but now if I don't do it, I'll feel like, you know, and then the show goes badly, I'll be like, well, it's because I didn't grow my tail today.
The tail was incorrect.
And the other thing I do is when I move into a theatre for the first time of the show, I like to walk the stalls and touch all the seats.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I just walk all the rows. It's partly superstition, but partly it's also just to get a good sense of the space, so you know what your volume needs to be.
Yes.
Just to, yeah, to make sure you're hitting the back of the room. But anyway, peacock feathers. There's various different, I think there's various cultures in which Hindu, in which peacock feathers are considered good luck, but I think several European countries, including Ireland and Britain and in Eastern Europe, peacock feathers are considered bad luck. And similarly, in the theatre, having a peacock feather on stage, some actors consider them to cause chaos. And there's, again, various different suggestions. One is that the pattern on the feather, because they create that eye, there is some superstition about it being an evil eye, yep. Which is, you know, the curse, you know, mentioned in the Bible as far back, the idea of the evil eye. But there's also a fear that, particularly for the superstition around peacock feathers in Eastern Europe, the suggestion is that this dates to the 13th century, because peacocks and peacock feathers were associated with the Mongols and the Mongol hordes, so-called, terrified Eastern Europe. They'd gotten as far as Hungary by 1242. And it was only the death of Genghis Khan's successor that led them, you know, retreating, if you wish. And so the suggestion is that the Mongols, this terrifying group who laid waste to so many Europeans with their penchant for peacock feathers, means that, rightly so, people in Eastern Europe not so fond of the peacock. Other things that are meant to be bad luck on stage, real money and real jewellery. Apparently that's... The suggestion is that they would just be stolen from the props table, which is probably true.
Yeah, they
knowing what we're like. and mirrors, of course. Not the idea that you might drop them and break them, but because they interfere with the lights.
Oh, that's why. I always thought it was weird, considering, you know, it's a profession in which it is important what you look like.
Yeah, no, having them on stage, obviously, lighting technicians not huge fans of that. Whistling backstage, do you know this one?
Yes, that's because of the rigging, because basically you'd get often old sailors would do like the ropes and stuff like that, and they would communicate via whistling.
Mm. Yeah, they, you know, obviously they didn't have walkie-talkies or any of that stuff, so they'd indicate to one another to, you know, fly in a bit of set or raise and lower the curtains and so on by whistles, and it would cue them. And if you were whistling backstage, you might accidentally cause a sandbag to be dropped in your head or something like that. And so it's still considered backstage bad luck to whistle backstage, even though nowadays most cues are issued via radio. And learning lines. Did you ever have a trick for learning lines when you were doing plays?
Yes, I did. It's a similar sort of trick to the one I used to revising. I had a little 6 foot by 3 foot snooker table in one of our rooms. So I just used to play snooker, and every time I missed a ball, I'd learn a line.
so you learned them quite quickly then?
No. Well, at first, yes, but then I became too good at snooker and I was appalling on stage.
To pot or not to pot.
It's just, it's basically for big speeches. You just learn a few lines, say them and say them and say them, and then it's sort of like see how long you can get along the tightrope before you learn it. And you get the rhythm of it as well. That's rhythm really helps me.
Yeah, rhythm is good. And I think, I mean, there's a lot of line learning apps now. I use an app to learn my lines. It's great. You read the entire scene, pressing a different button for each character, and then you can set it so it just blanks out.
Oh, that is great.
All the lines I've denoted as my character, and he just has everyone else's lines, so in the gaps in between. Or you can do a setting where it'll leave a gap and then it'll say your line so that you can say what you think the line is, and then you hear it confirmed, and then it'll keep going. So yeah, lots of ingenious apps like that. I think the other thing for people, if anyone's ever done a play, the funny thing is you learn the words and then you get up and you have to try and, you know, add the emotion on top of it. And I know left brain and right brain isn't a real thing, but it's certainly when you try and delve into the emotion, it's amazing how quickly the lines disappear out of your brain. The memory side doesn't interact with the emotion side too well. And then again, as what happens, you go into a theatre when you're doing the tech rehearsal and you have to be standing in the right place or moving the bit of set to the right place. And it's like trying to rub your tummy, pat your head and... Mm-hmm. Do keepy uppies all at the same time. But no, there's a theatrical tradition that you could learn your lines better if you sleep with the script under your pillow.
I thought you were going to say you learn your lines better if you sleep with the assistant director.
Yeah, because they'll say them in their sleep after. The science obviously says no, but there is a lot of, you know, manifestation teachings these days which get people to, you know, write your wishes on your diaries or your journals or your sheets of paper and put them under your pillow and manifest things that way. So if that's something that people want to do, then maybe it'll work for them. It depends how thick the script is as well. It mightn't be very comfortable if it's, you know, Angels in America, both parts. but let's talk about Macbeth. Do you know any of the particular reasons why people say don't say Macbeth?
Is it because the Scottish are inherently distrustful and evil?
That aside, and Ben's wife isn't in the room with him at the moment, just to reassure listeners. There's a couple of different suggestions. I mean, there's lots, as there are with lots of these things, there's lots of stories about various mishaps befalling people, and we'll talk about some of them in a minute. But the most popular explanation for it, it seems to be that if a theatre company put on Macbeth, it's probably a sign that the company isn't doing all that well.
Because it wouldn't shift tickets?
No, because it would. So the reason a company might suddenly do Macbeth is because it's the shortest Shakespeare play, so it's the easiest one at short notice to learn, and it's popular, so it'll get people in to make up for flagging ticket sales that they may have been suffering beforehand. So if the company had to resort to doing Macbeth, it meant things probably weren't going well for them. So it might be suddenly announced if the theatre was struggling.
That takes away a lot of the mystique around Macbeth, because it's not about it being spooky and the spirit of the witches and all of Macbeth's victims are going to come get us. It's just, it reflects poor financial reality.
Financial planning, yeah, yes. I mean, there is, you know, obviously there are some beliefs that the incantations like Double Double Toil and Trouble and so on, that there are actual witchcraft, and so it's dangerous to mention the title out loud because it's a demonic play to be doing. But there are some fun stories about various mishaps, as I said. Apparently, the story goes that in its first performance around 1606, the actor that was to play Lady Macbeth died suddenly, so Shakespeare himself had to take on the role. And other mishaps that they say might have happened at the time was that there were real daggers used in place of stage props, meaning that the guy who played Duncan actually died.
Oh no!
And obviously, using real weapons and things on stage or on film, never a great idea.
No.
Other stories, in Amsterdam in 1672, the actor playing Duncan was accidentally murdered on stage. During 1849, I think you talked about the Astor Place riot.
We did, yes.
In the podcast history, yeah. That was in 1849 in New York. There was a rivalry between the American actor Edwin Forrest and the English actor William Charles MacCready, where they were both playing Macbeth in opposing productions down the street from one another, and their various fans ended up in riots. Can you imagine? Can you imagine, like, a McKellen fan and a Patrick Stewart fan having, like, organising armies if they were playing opposing King Lears or something like that?
It would be mad. Well, also, I'm trying to think out of McKellen and Paddy Stewart, who would have the better strategic nous to lead their armies to victory. I mean, like, McKellen's army would be more motivated, but I think Patrick Stewart would bring all those years as a space commander play. I would be able to outflank McKellen's troops ultimately.
Yeah, I think very likely. But yes, there were apparently during the Astor Place riots there were 20 deaths and over 100 injuries, which is topped the number of deaths and injuries nearly in the play itself. 1937, Laurence Olivier was going to play in Macbeth at the Old Vic, and he lost his voice, and then a weight fell from the wings of the theatre and nearly killed him. He survived, obviously enough, but a few days later the manager of the theatre, Lillian Bayliss, died of a heart attack.
Oh gosh. So apparently unconnected things happened.
Also, apparently one of the swords used in a fight scene slipped out of an actor's hand during one performance, flew into the audience and injured a patron.
Okay. I mean, yeah. I'm sure when you're in the play and in the theatre and all that, that yes, certainly it'll seem a lot more terrifying and spooky. But I find it hard to get spooked out by Macbeth. Words which are,
of course, and the thing is, it's the nature of the thing is that it's been 400 years and it's been produced over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Whereas, you know, a production of one of my plays has happened once. You know, if someone slips at one point, it's not a curse. But if you're doing the play hundreds of different productions in history, obviously occasionally things that go wrong
I would prefer, if any of your plays do get cursed, then I would prefer it to be Vespertilio, because at least the reputation of bats is already sort of pretty low. I'd hate it if it was the current one. People are like, oh, have you seen the cursed gay adoption play? Like, oh,
cursed gay adoption play, yes. So Are gays cursed, or is it babies? That's the question. 1942, during the London production of Macbeth, in which John Gielgud was starring, three of the actors died in the show. And on the day it opened, the set designer killed themselves. 1947, Harold Norman was playing Macbeth when one of the battle scenes... one of the battle scenes apparently got out of hand and he was killed on stage.
Well, I mean, that's quite some method acting.
It really is, yeah. They had a different actor play Macbeth every day because they kept killing them. And I quite like this one. In 1948, the British actress Diana Wynyard was playing Lady Macbeth, and she told a reporter she thought the curse was obviously ridiculous, and the following night she was doing the sleepwalking scene and walked right off the stage and fell into the orchestra pit.
I don't like either... The curse is a real thing, or there must be something psychological where you thumb your nose at death and then subconsciously let your guard down.
Yeah. Oh, no, I mean, you're just asking for it then, aren't you? John Bell was in Macbeth in 1967 playing Lennox, and he recounted that Peter Hall, who was the director, contracted a severe attack of shingles and the production had to be postponed for 6 weeks. 2011, Jonathan Slinger was playing Macbeth at the RSC. He was knocked off his bike on the way to the theatre and broke his arm. And in 2012, Peter Evans was directing Macbeth for Bell Shakespeare. And loads of the cast members apparently got food poisoning.
Oh, no.
So they had to cancel opening night. They were so badly poisoned that apparently two actors and the assistant director were hospitalised. Thankfully, all was well, but... When you're shitting and vomiting so badly because of food poisoning, you have to go to the hospital. You start to think, yeah, maybe Macbeth is cursed after all. But there is a remedy. Do you know what the way to cure yourself if you accidentally say Macbeth?
Is it to read three Christopher Hitchens essays in succession?
Not quite, but apparently you should exit the theatre, spin around three times, spit, and utter a Shakespearean insult. Do you have a favourite Shakespearean insult?
Oh, I don't. My old flatmate did have a brilliant a collection of fridge magnets, which were all Shakespearean insults, but I can't think of one off the top of my head. I'm sure you do.
I think young Macduff, when the murderers come to kill him and his mother in Macbeth, calls one of the murderers, "You egg!" Which I really
like. I mean, that's Shakespeare writing the in-betweeners.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the same scene he says, "Mother, he has killed me," which which I think is in the wrong tense.
It is, but it's... I mean, that's one of the greatest lines ever written. I love it.
Yeah, I think people who are Blackadder fans will remember from Blackadder the Third, I think it's Hugh Paddock, and yes, I think it's Kenneth Connor. Hugh Paddock and Ken Connor play two sort of restoration comedy or Georgian comedy actors who are very superstitious, trying to teach the Prince George how to declaim his speeches. Mm-hmm.
To stand and roll.
Yes, exactly. And but Edmund Blackadder keeps saying Macbeth, and they keep doing this stupid dance to ward off the bad luck. So, which I think is a nod to that. So that's a little gallop through some theatrical superstitions and traditions. As I say, if any of you are in London, the next two, 3 weeks, come and see my 4- and 5-star play. I'd love to see some of you there. And you can imagine what tale I've grown before the curtain comes
up. That's it. I imagine if you're playing Hamlet, you grow a very different tale to the one than if you're playing Ophelia. I don't know why I've gone for gender-blind casting, but...
Well, if you're playing Hamlet, presumably I'm growing a Great Dane's tale.
Oh, come on now.
Dagger drop, we out.
Quite beautifully said.